Now you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Ashwini Mate representing William Vronin, and I will try to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honors, unless you have other questions about the other issues in this case, including the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, I intend to focus my comments today on this court's improper, on the district court's improper delegation of judicial power to the probation.
I at least have a question about the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. We got a letter from the government on, I believe it was January 24th, that Mr. Vronin is still at large. To your knowledge, does that continue to be the case today?
To my knowledge, I believe Mr. Vronin has been in contact with this probation officer, and again, I believe he's still in the jurisdiction of this court. Nothing in the bench warrant indicated that he had fled. The government hasn't proven that he's actually fled the jurisdiction of this court. In fact, the last time they argued the fugitive disentitlement doctrine applied here, Mr. Vronin was found in the exact area the bench warrant indicates that he could be found now. I think this is a very messy application of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. The more traditional application is, the government has proven that a client has escaped custody or has fled the jurisdiction of the courts. And in fact, this court has held for the fugitive disentitlement doctrine to apply. We require some further showing that the defendant has fled or has hidden himself from the jurisdiction of the court, and that just isn't the case here.
Well, but the warrant was issued. Has the warrant been executed?
Not as far as I know, Your Honor.
Do you know where he is, like, right now?
We believe he is somewhere in the location indicated in the bench warrant in Whittier. Which is precisely where he was found before.
Okay, but counsel, I know it's tough here, but you said we believe. That's not the same as we know. So I take the answer as you don't know where he is right now.
Your Honor, I wasn't privy to the phone conversation that he had with this probation officer, but I'm under the impression that they know that he is in that location.
Okay, again, the question was, do you know where he is? And I take it the answer to that is you do not know.
I don't know.
Okay.
But again, Your Honor, it seems as if... Sorry.
No, I guess what I'm trying to circle back to as well is I'm not sure really what we're trying to accomplish here, and here's why I say that. As I understand it, your client was sentenced to 60 days. Your client served that time. You want us now to do what?
Well, Your Honor, remand with instructions for the district court about how to, in particular this condition, which delegates to the probation officer the ability to determine whether Mr. Vronin should go into a residential reentry center, which is a halfway house under the BOP, and more importantly, for how long. I've never before seen a condition where a probation officer is permitted to determine how long a defendant can serve in a residential reentry center.
All right,
or a halfway house.
So if your client were to show up tomorrow, I mean, it's kind of hard to remand this to the district court when we don't know where your client is, but if we send this case back to the district court, what argument that you're making to us now could you not make to the district court tomorrow?
Your Honor, I think without instruction from this court, the court could, still reimpose the same condition. I mean, as far as I know, there's a possibility that the condition imposed in this case or the improperly delegated condition is the source of the violation petition. Again, we're not privy to the violation petition. They're filed under seal. So I don't know for a fact, and I can't state that before this court, but it could very easily be the source of his current violation, which if this court were to find that that condition was improper, would mean that this current violation would go away.
And you could make all of those arguments to the district court, correct?
We could, Your Honor, but it would be probably easier for this court to issue that kind of, guidance for the district court to follow, since it didn't matter in the first instance.
So you understand then the risk, though, is that let's say it goes back to the district court and the district court says, okay, you're right, I'll change the halfway house, but I'm now going to sentence your client to 6 months in prison. That could happen. And even though he's already served the 60 days and he's done with that, the risk is that by carrying through this appeal, he could get more time. And that's why I'm a little puzzled why you're pursuing this.
I mean, Your Honor, I think that there would be other arguments we could make about why custody would be inappropriate in this context. I mean, there were the same arguments that were made below. I think we made them even on appeal with respect to the Tapia error. So, I mean, it's a risk we take, but there are limitations to what the district court can do. And I think guidance from this court about how they would have to conduct that hearing would be helpful, beneficial.
But I guess what I'm trying to figure out here is that if there's been no real contact with your client, and now there's this second petition, It seems like there's a lot of discussions that would need to go on with your client about what he should be doing right now in this appeal, because it could affect everything. And if those conversations haven't happened, it just, I don't know, I'm still a little puzzled as to why this appeal is being pursued, considering he spent the 60 days. But that's ultimately, that's your call.
And Your Honor, you know, we are under an obligation to pursue an appeal if our client files a notice of appeal, and until and unless they indicate to us that they don't wish to pursue it.
But if you're not in contact with the person, doesn't that kind of beg the question whether this is, the circumstances have changed, right, since this, circumstances have changed a lot since the notice of appeal was filed. And I take it there haven't really been any ability to communicate with him to say, hey, you know what, that was then, this is now, without telling us what those communications were. And again, you're in a tough spot here. I mean, I'm not faulting you at all. You're in a very tough spot. But I don't know, this is maybe more Judge Christensen's land, what he has to deal with every day, than what I have to deal with now. But it just, you know, I'm just a little concerned about where this case is going here. But anyway, that's just me. And
Let me ask you a couple of questions. I don't want to relive the actual revocation hearing itself, the proceeding. But where was Mr. Voronin at the time of the revocation proceeding? He was not in custody, was he?
No, he was on the street on the phone with his cousin.
With his cousin. And of course, the cousin has played a role, as I understand it, in Mr. Voronin's well-being. Where was Mr. Voronin's lawyer at the time? Was she or he or she at his side or on a separate phone somewhere?
They were on a separate phone.
Okay. And was this, what was the protocol, standing order in the Central District of California when this proceeding occurred? Were people coming into the courthouse in person, or was everything being done remotely?
I believe that most things were being done remotely at that time. And in this case, there was a document that was being required, that counsel were being required to file in every case, stating whether or not they would consent to proceed by video or telephone.
And that was, I looked at the docket that was filed in this case. So going to Judge Owen's question, because I've had the same, I've been struggling with this. I can't understand what it is that you want Judge Hatter to do if we were to remand this case. I mean, what's going to happen if we remand it?
I mean, my hope is that Judge Hatter, you know, through the arguments of counsel and the guidance of this court, would understand that, you know, custody and further supervision is inappropriate in the context, given this client's extensive history of mental illness.
Okay, and that argument was made at the time of the initial revocation hearing. Mr. Voronin's counsel made a very strong argument that the system simply is not equipped to deal with his mental health conditions, and advocated that he be termed out. And Judge Hatter expressly stated, you know, I'm going to give this one more try, because I think we are acting in the best interest of Mr. Voronin, and I'm going to 2 months of custody, and then we're going to keep him on supervised release for what, 16, 18 months. And he expressly stated, and if you are still homeless, you shall reside for a period not to exceed 365 days in a residential reentry center. You shall observe the rules, etc., of the facility. And he said, any fee associated with that will be waived due to your lack of financial ability to pay. So it sounds like what you would like to do is redo what's already been done as it relates to Mr. Voronin, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to that condition in particular.
Well, isn't he empowering the probation office to essentially look at the situation when Mr. Voronin gets out? If he doesn't have a place to live, then the probation office, with this special condition in place, then has the discretion to put him into a residential reentry center. I mean, that's the way this works, I think. It's not mandatory. It's a condition that allows, it's like, It's like substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment. We impose these special conditions and let our probation officers exercise some discretion and some judgment as to what the defendant needs at that point in time after they've completed the custodial sentence, right?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think I've seen a condition quite like this where they're empowering the probation officer to determine whether or not he's actually subject to the condition. I think the law and I think more importantly, for how long. You know, the district court didn't create a set term. They simply said not to exceed 365 days. So if the probation officer determines that Mr. Veronin is homeless based on their, you know, understanding of that concept, you know, maybe couch surfing counts, maybe it doesn't, maybe one day on a couch counts, maybe it doesn't. You know, the probation officer is then empowered to effectively sentence Mr. Veronin to 1 month in a quasi-custodial environment, 2 months, 3 months. And then what's Mr. Veronin to do? Can he prove that he's no longer homeless to the probation officer in order to be released earlier than the 365 days?
Oh, boy.
I think this is a rather troubling condition. And in my experience, there's usually, you know, at least, probation officers have the power to, you know, interpret some of these conditions, but the result is that they only get to violate the defendant. And then the defendant goes into court and gets to invoke the adversarial process and the judicial power of the courts to ultimately sanction him. In this condition, the probation officer is essentially being made, you know, the judge, jury, and executioner, for lack of a better phrase. And so I think that makes this a very and highly problematic delegation of the court's judicial power in the context of this condition.
Okay, one final question. Has there been a new petition to revoke Mr. Veronin been filed?
So we are not privy to that information. It's, you know, if a petition has been filed, it's been filed under seal. We can only assume that when a bench warrant issues that a violation petition is usually accompanying that, but I don't actually have, you know, that information or what the grounds of that petition would be.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll give you a minute for rebuttal, okay?
Thank you.
And counsel for the government may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Assistant United States Attorney Maria Jai on behalf of the United States. With respect to the Fugitive Disentitlement Doctrine, the government shares the court's expressions of concern about what would happen upon remand. I want to note at the outset that the concerns of the Fugitive Disentitlement Doctrine are partially grounded in the enforceability of the court's judgments. Here we have a defendant who is absconded and is wanted on a bench warrant. He will inevitably be brought back before the district court where issues raised potentially objections to certain conditions could be ventilated with the district court. Nonetheless, even if this court were to have to issue a decision, that circumstance doesn't change. And the defendant is still missing and has, in that sense, removed himself from the jurisdiction of the court. It's not a matter of whether he's residing or could eventually be located in the Central District. It is that he is, his whereabouts are unknown. And that's the information that the government received and put in its letter to the court in response to the court's inquiry.
Do you know whether or not he has been in contact with his probation officer in the last few days?
I don't have that information. I had the one conversation following up on the court's request for information about the status of his supervision, and the information that I received was conveyed in the letter. I understood at that time that his whereabouts were unknown and that a bench warrant had issued, and I haven't followed up further.
I'm getting the impression from listening to counsel for Mr. Veronin this morning that folks know where he is. I mean, he's a homeless person. They've got a pretty good idea where he is. It appears as if he has not been arrested. I mean, I don't know what goes on down here in, you know, wherever in Los Angeles or wherever we are, but is it not uncommon that homeless people that may be subject to the court's jurisdiction or may be subject to an arrest warrant are just simply not arrested for a period of time?
Well, so Mr. Veronin is on supervision, so there's a certain, to the extent somebody's saying his whereabouts are unknown, it's not because an arrest warrant issued and he wasn't able to be found. It's things preceded that. So there's an inability to know his location in advance. And the other thing to direct Your Honor's attention to is the confidential sentencing documents, which are the violation report. And that gives some background in terms of difficulties. So as the probation office reported there, from the outset of supervision, Mr. Voronin was homeless. And there were difficulties enforcing the court's orders and supervision because he could not be found by the probation officer, and he didn't report. So I'm not sure the difference if you have a defendant who is, number one, not complying with the terms of supervision and showing up when he's supposed to. Number two, as the violation report indicated, had a place to live, had places lived arranged for him, and chose not to reside there, with the result that he was out of reach of supervision. And I think that's the circumstance that we're in with respect to the status of efforts to effect this arrest warrant. I don't have information about that. It certainly doesn't change Mr. Voronin's status in terms of not being subject to supervision right now, and not complying with the order. If the court doesn't have any further questions about that, I do want to address the impermissible delegation argument. Two points in particular, actually three. So number one, the determination whether somebody is homeless is not discretionary. It's not a vesting of unreasonable discretion in the probation office. It's actually pretty standard. And one place to look is the original judgment in this case, which is at ER 24. And there's a standard condition number six that requires the defendant to reside in a location approved by the probation officer. That's the same kind of discretion we're talking about here, but here it's actually narrower. And we can see sort of the background of why that condition exists in this case, because of Mr. Voronin's history of being homeless and therefore being difficult to supervise, which is the probation officer's job. But so the determination here is he homeless? If he is homeless, the condition provides, he shall reside in an RRC, a residential reentry center.
What condition is that? I'm looking at the original judgment.
It should be ER 24, standard condition number 6.
All right. Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. So the government does take this condition to be mandatory because that's the court's use of its sentencing power. The court is the one who said, if Mr. Voronin is homeless, he must reside in an RRC. That's the court's exercise of its authority, and that's proper under Stevens. Now, with respect to the time, that is also this provision that not to exceed 365 days or up to 365 days, that's also entirely consistent with this court's decision in Stevens. In Stevens, the order was for drug testing, and the question was whether the district court erred by not setting either a specific number of drug tests on supervision or a maximum number. And this court said, well, there was error because the court didn't set the maximum number. It would have been okay to set a permissible range, but the court did have to set the maximum. And what this court did here, consistent with its statutory authority to order the defendant to be on residential reentry for all or part of the period of supervision, is the court said up to 365 days. That's a permissible setting of the time period under Stevens, and that's what the court did here. The third point that I want to address about the delegation concern is that there are, if the court does have concerns about it, there are alternatives to remand for resentencing. Those alternatives could be, as this court has done before, you could find plain error and say nonetheless, there's no effect on substantial rights. And this court has done that with Stevens' error before. The other thing the court could do is a limited remand to tweak that particular condition to make it consistent with whatever the court identified as error. But again, here, the government doesn't see error in that condition.
Did Did Mr. Veronin expressly waive his right to a hearing?
Yes. Yes. He was asked by the district court, do you give up your right to a hearing? And he said, I give up that right.
Well, he said no at one point, and then he later said yes. Go ahead.
So the district court, in assessing whether defendant made a knowing and intelligent waiver, can look at the totality of the circumstances, the whole record. And there are multiple things here in addition to defendant's statements. The first thing is that when the court started the hearing, he asked defense counsel, how does your client wish to proceed? And she said, my understanding is Mr. Veronin intends to admit the allegations. And then she participated in eliciting her client's waiver and his understanding of his right to a hearing. So that's an indication to the district court that is part of the record, a relevant part of the record, that there were communications between defense counsel and her client prior to the hearing, and an agreement about how to proceed. Now, Mr. Veronin's comments during the hearing are consistent with that, not only with the statement, I give up that right, but also with his admission almost instantly in response to questioning, I admit I smoked marijuana. He's kind of proceeding with the game plan. He's admitting the allegations against him. And the parts of the record that the government highlighted were particularly statements by defendant where there was an engagement with the court and a expression or response to court questioning, and also just volunteering information that showed that he understood why he was there. Also, the USPO violation report is part of the record that indicates whether the probation officer is reporting Mr. Veronin's prior statements where he said, I'm not going to stop using meth, or he didn't take a urine test because he told the probation officer that he was afraid he would test positive. These are things that are part of the record before this district court, who was the same court at sentencing, the same court in taking Mr. Veronin's guilty plea on the substance, that show that defendant understands, but he's willfully failing to comply. That's part of the record in this case.
You've pointed to some of the things he said at the hearing or at the proceeding, but he also said a lot of things that really did not make any sense, and that might lead a person to conclude that he didn't have any understanding of what was going on. At what point does the district court have an obligation to conduct some further inquiry into whether the defendant really understands the proceeding? Waiving.
One issue here is there could be a claim in some circumstances, not here, where the district court has an obligation to sua sponte, inquire into a defendant's competency. That's not this case. That's not a claim that defense counsel has raised or defendant has raised. So what the district court did here was, and this is different than Correa-Torres, which is the only case that defendant cited on this point, is engaged directly with defendant, inquired of defendant with the assistance of defense counsel about the waiver of the right to hearing, and reviewed each of the counts against the defendant. And during those interactions, the defendant was responding on the substance, and the defendant it was not mere nodding, it was not acquiescence in counsel's representations. There was a colloquy that occurred, and in the colloquy that occurred, the defendant said things that indicated understanding. He said some things that are difficult to categorize. I would say the buckets are inaudible statements, as well as statements that sort of indicate dissatisfaction with application of the law. But nonetheless, the reason the government focused on the sentences that it did is because they are volunteered, complete, whole sentence information that is responsive to the inquiry and responsive to the proceedings that the defendant was taking part in. And I also do want to say this was a telephonic hearing, but you get things from a telephonic hearing that you don't get from typed words on a page. You get tone of voice, articulation, pauses, and those are things that the district court was able to pick up on as well.
Let me ask you the same question I asked your colleague. Let's assume that Judge Hatter, shortly into this proceeding, this hearing, says, oh goodness, number one, the court reporter can't hear what's being said. I mean, this is obviously COVID world hearings, which we've all lived through at the trial court level, and quite frankly, they're a mess, can be a mess. And let's suppose Judge Hatter threw up his hands and said, I'm not going to proceed any further this morning. I'm not comfortable with the state of mind of Mr. Voronin, and here's what I'd like to have happen. We're going to continue this hearing. We're going to have an in-person hearing a week from today. Was that even possible in November of 2020? Were there in-person hearings being held in the Central District of California? Do you know?
I do not know that off the top of my head. It seems like the COVID experience has been going on forever. I
suspect in November of 2020, if it was like most of the courthouses in the United States, federal courthouses, and particularly in California, to my knowledge, they probably weren't.
They were not.
Okay, this is as good as it was going to get, other than maybe Zoom. Anyway, okay, I don't have any further questions.
And with that, okay, great. Counsel for Mr. Voronin, let's give her two. You just got boosted by 100%.
Your Honors, I'd just like to quickly address the issue of the decision in Stevens permitting the district court to set the maximum limit of drug tests that could be imposed on a defendant on supervision. And the court did that in Stevens because of a specific statutory authority in 3583, I believe it's D, that permitted the court, based on the language in 3583 D, that actually allowed district courts to set a maximum number of drug tests. I'm sorry, but we don't have any such similar statutory authority here permitting a district court to set the maximum term of residential reentry and not specify a specific term of residential reentry that a defendant needs to be subject to on supervision. So I think it is still an improper delegation to the probation officer about the extent of a punitive sanction that the defendant might be subject to. And I'd also like to argue that on ER 24, or I believe it's actually ER 23, the standard condition of supervision, I think that just compiles discretion on discretion. Again, as I've briefed, the term homeless is subjective and subject to interpretation. And here, based on the probation officer's, interpretation of whether or not a house is, permissible, again, the probation officer is permitted to sentence Mr. Voronin to a custodial environment for, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. And lastly, I understand this court's concern about what could happen on remand, but I truly believe an application of the Fugitive Disentitlement Doctrine in this context, where the court is effectively having to make fact findings in the first instance about Mr. Veronin's mental state, where he is highly problematic. It's just not a clean application of the doctrine here, and it would be, a rather large expansion of it if it was to apply in this context. Again, this court has twice determined that they would not apply this doctrine in the context of abstention from supervision, particularly where in United States versus Gonzalez, the defendant hadn't fled the jurisdiction. And that sentiment from United States versus Gonzalez was, affirmed in Murguia-Oliveras, where they said that, this court requires some showing that the defendant has actually hidden themselves from the jurisdiction of the court. And, that it was this jurisdictional issue not being here that really animated the concern about the disentitlement doctrine, where the court wouldn't be able to enforce a judgment. I think, government counsel effectively conceded that he will probably be found and be brought back into the jurisdiction of the district court in this matter. And again, that's because he is still here, to the best of my knowledge. I can't say that I know for certain, but I am led to believe that he has been in contact with this probation officer as early as last week. And with that, Your Honor, I will submit.
Can I ask one final question of either of you? I looked at the original judgment in this case, and if it's not in the record, then I don't want to know. But if it's in the record, I'd like to know. What was Mr. Voronin's criminal history category at the time of his original sentencing? If it's in the record, I want to know. If it's not in the record, I don't want to know.
It's in the record, Your Honor. It's in the PSR that I believe the government filed under seal. He was in criminal history category 6.
6? All right, thank you.
All right, thank you both for your argument in this interesting case, let's just say. Interesting issues, no doubt. Thank you both for your briefing and your argument. This matter is submitted.